Hi, this is Vika Aronson, podcast producer from the PBS NewsHour. Before we get back to the episode, I'd like to tell you about another promotional partner podcast, In Recovery, from Lemonada Media. Everyone's life has been impacted by addiction in one way or another. In Recovery is a weekly podcast for those in need of information about the science, research, and reality of addiction. In Recovery is hosted by Dr. Nzinga Harrison, a physician board certified in psychiatry and addiction medicine. It offers listeners a heartfelt approach to treating all kinds of addiction. You can listen on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. On this Memorial Day, as the COVID-19 death toll climbs closer to 100,000, we consider the enormity of loss and the push to return to normal. Then, a summer like no other. Relaxing social restrictions spells relief for some and fear for others. Plus, an outsized impact. Why the Navajo Nation and some other tribes are seeing some of the country's highest rates of COVID-19 infections.
A lot of Native families, there are at least 5 or 6 to 8 to 10 people living in one household, and it's really disheartening to see that it can spread so easily.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. As our nation honored those who gave their lives in service to the country today, the U.S. death toll from the COVID-19 pandemic topped 98,000. More areas loosened their coronavirus restrictions over the holiday weekend, and President Trump ramped up his push to reopen the country even more. Lisa Desjardins has our report.
Present!
Present!
Arms!
In many ways, it looked like Memorial Day's past. President Trump and Vice President Pence this morning visited the tomb of the unknown soldier at Arlington National Cemetery. But it was different. No crowd and no speech there. Similarly, many beaches looked just like the start of summer. But those crowds in a still uncontained national health crisis felt very different.
It's insane on how many people are out here today. I didn't expect this at all. We came over here and we're like, wow.
All 50 states are reopening in some way, with some, like Georgia, moving more quickly, while others, like Illinois, move more slowly by region. The changes are bringing relief and concern both. Many pointed to this social media video from Lake of the Ozarks in Missouri, with scores of people jammed together at a pool party. In New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo blasted efforts to reopen any place where COVID-19 case numbers are still rising.
It's not smart. It defies history, defies everything we know, defies common sense.
With a spectrum of different circumstances across the country, some U.S. health officials are issuing notes of caution. The commissioner for the Food and Drug Administration tweeted a warning yesterday, writing, "The coronavirus is not yet contained." For former Vice President Joe Biden, a new careful step. The presumptive Democratic presidential nominee made his first public appearance outside in months, laying a wreath at a veterans park. Something new for President Trump, too. He spoke not at Arlington Cemetery, but at Baltimore's Fort McHenry today. He praised the military's pandemic response.
In recent months, our nation and the world have been engaged in a new form of battle against an invisible enemy. Once more, the men and women of the United States military have answered the call to duty and raced into danger.
Baltimore's mayor, Jack Young, had asked the president not to make the trip because the city is under stay-at-home orders. Earlier, the president wrote on Twitter that all schools should reopen soon. He also tweeted strong words about North Carolina, saying the state should commit to full capacity for the Republican National Convention planned in Charlotte for August. Or, he wrote, the GOP should move it to another state. His comments came days after North Carolina recorded its largest daily increase in cases yet. The state's governor said they are working with the GOP and relying on data and science to make decisions. All this comes amid new travel restrictions to the U.S. Sunday, the Trump administration banned entry to foreigners leaving from Brazil. That country now has the second highest number of confirmed coronavirus cases in the world, behind the U.S. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Lisa Desjardins.
In the day's other news, top Democrats slammed the Trump administration's national COVID-19 testing strategy a day after it was sent to Congress. In a statement, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and others said the president's strategy is to, quote, deny the truth that there aren't enough tests and supplies, reject responsibility, and dump the burden onto the states. The British Prime Minister's closest aide defied calls to quit today over accusations that he ignored coronavirus lockdown measures. Dominic Cummings drove 250 miles from London to northern England in March with his wife, who was symptomatic, so that his parents could care for his young son. Cummings said that he was in an exceptional situation and acted reasonably.
I don't regret what I did. And I think that the way that I dealt with it was the least risk to everybody concerned if my wife and I had both been unable to look after our four-year-old.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson also defended Cummings' decision, saying that he acted both legally and responsibly. Back in this country, the Republican National Committee and two other Republican groups filed a lawsuit to block California's move to voting by mail this November. Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom issued the order over concerns about the spread of COVID-19. But Republicans argued in Sunday's filing that mail-in ballots would invite fraud. A federal judge ruled Sunday night that a Florida law requiring felons to pay legal fees before they can vote is unconstitutional. That clears the way for hundreds of thousands of people to potentially regain the right to vote. Floridians voted to restore voter rights for felons in 2018, but Governor Ron DeSantis signed a bill limiting it to only those who had paid their court-related debts. Officials in China today defended proposed national security legislation that would crack down on opposition activity in Hong Kong. That comes a day after more than 180 pro-democracy activists were arrested in the semi-autonomous territory in the largest protest there since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. Beijing's proposed laws would ban the demonstrations and classify them as terrorism.
The bill is targeted at a small number of behaviors that seriously harm the national security. It does not affect the rights and freedoms enjoyed by Hong Kong residents.
Protests began in Hong Kong last June after Beijing introduced a now tabled bill that would have caused the semi-autonomous territory to lose its special status. And former CBS Washington Bureau Chief William Small has died after a brief illness not related to the coronavirus. Under his leadership, the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite maintained its number one slot for 20 years. The veteran newsman also helped to mold CBS News coverage during the Vietnam War and Watergate. William Small was 93 years old. Still to come on the NewsHour, the unofficial start of summer amid coronavirus, perspectives on reopening. High political stakes in a pandemic as party organizers question what the summer's conventions could look like, and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
As states continue to move toward reopening today, the Navajo Nation emerged from a strict weekend lockdown and police-enforced curfew, its seventh so far. Native Americans have been experiencing disproportionately high rates of infection and death from COVID-19. In this report, part of our series, Race Matters, Stephanie Tsai explains that even smaller tribes consider the pandemic an existential threat.
Ground zero for COVID-19 cases in New Mexico is the town of Gallup, on the edge of the Navajo Nation.
I'm like, well, we live in Gallup. It's not going to come here.
Navajo nurse Kelly Manuelito treated the first COVID-positive patient to arrive at Rehoboth McKinley Christian Healthcare Services. She works in the intensive care unit.
A lot of Native families, there are at least 5 or 6 to 8 to 10 people living in one household. And it's really disheartening to see that it can spread so easily.
The staff of the ICU was overwhelmed when they saw a spike in COVID patients in late April, tied to an outbreak among the homeless population.
It's definitely scary. I don't know one single worker who is not scared to come up. We've been working extra hours, extra days, and it's been really rough.
She says she's been able to take a break in recent days. The New Mexico governor lifted a week-long lockdown after fewer cases were recently reported. But the toll has been devastating on Native peoples in New Mexico. They account for 50% of all of the state's COVID-19 deaths, even though they make up only 11% of the population.
I grew up in the northwestern part of New Mexico.
Jordan Bennett Begay, a reporter for Indian Country Today, spends hours a day compiling reports of Native American COVID cases and deaths. It's a stark spreadsheet that tells a sad, still unfolding story.
There was a point where one day I counted there are 60 people in our database. That night after recording like 10 deaths in one day, I broke down. I did cry because then these are, my relatives.
Relative has an expansive definition in Indian country. And on April 23rd, Valentina Blackhorse, a former Miss Western Navajo, was added to that list. Blackhorse lived in Kayenta, and her boyfriend, a correctional officer, had the virus. One day after she tested positive, she died at 28 years old.
I never thought she would get sick because, she kept telling us, stay home, wash your hands, wear your mask.
Danielle Blackhorse spoke to us a week after her big sister was laid to rest.
How a funeral should be, it wasn't like that. There was no chairs. My mom couldn't get comfort from her family. We had to stay in our vehicles until, they covered her. I'm heartbroken. It seems like a part of me has been ripped away.
In an effort to save Native American lives, tribal leaders have taken strict measures, including curfews and roadblocks. And in Washington state, the Lummi Nation has been uniquely proactive in testing its 5,300 members.
That everyone stay in their own homes and avoid interaction with your family members.
Springing into action after the first case in the U.S. was announced at a locale 1 hour away from the reservation.
So then we start putting orders everywhere that we could think of.
Dr. Christina Toledo Cornell is the public health director for the tribe. Besides ordering testing materials and medical equipment early on, they have been aggressively contact tracing.
So to us, it was very important to find every single case, because if we miss one or two, that could be catastrophic for a lot of people. And that allowed us to really be aggressive in terms of relaxing the testing criteria and doing as many tests as we could.
As a result, they've had dozens of confirmed cases, but no deaths. Back in New Mexico, there are significant clusters of cases in the state's pueblos. By one estimate, 11% of the Zia reservation of only 646 members were infected. At that rate, leaders are concerned about the risk of extinction.
We've been through this before with the Spanish flu, back in the early 1900s. The Pueblo of Pewaukee was reduced to just a few individuals.
Joseph Talachi is governor of the Pueblo of Pewaukee.
Our history is passed down through our language and through our spoken stories. And so any loss of our tribal elders would be a loss to our history.
He shut down the Pueblo early.
I knew that there was going to be consequences to that as well. People were going to be upset.
The Buffalo Thunder Casino Hotel is closed for business and instead being used to house COVID-19 patients from other area tribes. Casino closures since the pandemic are expected to directly affect basic services on tribal lands.
But it just takes a few mistakes to get this virus to peak back up, especially in Indian country.
An economy doesn't mean anything if you don't have people.
In northern Michigan, Brian Newland is the tribal chairperson of the Bay Mills Indian community.
This pandemic's impact on our community has been almost entirely economic at this point. I would estimate that right now we have about two-thirds of our tribal employees out of work. And then our tribe has a pretty sizable commercial fishing industry that's really been hit hard.
Back on the Navajo Nation, Karen Shell has felt that economic hit too. She runs a shop that's been in the family since 1948 and has been closed for months.
I have just hundreds and hundreds of Navajo people that sell to me.
Lost business for her means lost revenue for her local chapter house.
Those monies go to our community here. I'm not making anything, they're not getting anything.
But she says just down the road from her shop, fellow Navajo have died.
We know them by name and we know people who are sick right now. So I think everybody on the reservation knows somebody who is sick.
Nurse Kelly Manulito, while taking care of the sick, has been struggling herself.
I understand you're a mother and have had to distance from your own child.
I have. It's been the hardest thing to be away from her. Her name is Hayden. She is 5. For the past 5 years and 9 months of her life, I have told her every day, come hug mommy, come kiss mommy. My mission as a nurse is I am here to protect, and my job as a mother is to keep my daughter safe, to keep her surrounded by family and love.
Many will say it's that kinship that has helped Native people survive throughout time and against all odds. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai in Phoenix.
It is Memorial Day, and of course, our traditional kickoff to summer, and usually a busy vacation season. As states begin to reopen, John Yang reports on how beach towns and business owners are adjusting in the time of COVID-19.
Here at Rehoboth Beach, it's definitely a different Memorial Day.
Nick Caggiano has been selling pizza in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware for almost 50 years.
Last Memorial Day at this time, we were running around like chickens with our heads cut off, and we were all like having a bunch of fun because it's our first big weekend. You know?
This long holiday weekend, business has been half what it was last year. He's been limited to curbside pickup and a smaller staff. And the coronavirus pandemic has meant fewer people on the beach outside his restaurant. But in other places, from Texas to South Carolina, beaches were packed for summer's first weekend. In Daytona Beach, Florida, large crowds and no social distancing.
Were there massive crowds? Absolutely. Did we get invaded? Absolutely.
Overall, travel this weekend and into the summer will likely be down. Last year, 43 million Americans traveled over the Memorial Day weekend, according to AAA. TSA reported a staggering drop in airport screenings on Friday. Fewer than 350,000 people passed through checkpoints, down more than 87% from last year's record high. That's having a big impact on spending. The U.S. Travel Association projected that this Memorial Day weekend, Americans would spend just a third of what they did last year. Roger Dow is the group's president. He and other tourism industry leaders joined Vice President Mike Pence last week in Florida.
When you talk about beach towns, I'm so worried about them because if they don't make it during the summer, they don't make it. And I'm afraid many of them won't survive.
Our tourist season starts today. You know, we have 10 weeks to make cash.
Susan Kelleher runs a gift store and ice cream shop on Tybee Island in Georgia, one of the first states to reopen.
It's kind of just been a trial and error. We just do what we feel is okay. We do what we feel is safe and comfortable because we need to have the tourists back.
But she worries that some of those tourists could bring the virus. So she's limiting capacity at the ice cream shop to just one family at a time and asking everyone to use hand sanitizer.
It's a little bit of panic to believe that people are going to be coming and bringing the virus with them in droves.
On Cape Cod, that's not a worry for Andy Murphy. At his pub this weekend, bad weather combined with coronavirus and a restaurant that's currently takeout only made for a less than perfect season opening weekend.
It's a risk, but it might not be the doom and gloom that people have been led to believe as they've been homebound.
Right now, he's thinking more about the economic future.
I really have to face the storm and put people back to work. We have to regrow this economy here.
For local officials, reopening is a balancing act. In Bradley Beach, New Jersey, face masks were encouraged but not required.
When I hear a beach is crammed, I'm psyched. I'm happy. Now if I hear a beach is crammed, I'm concerned.
In the most recent PBS NewsHour NPR Marist poll, two-thirds of those questioned said life won't return to normal for at least 6 months. That could make for a long, slow summer for businesses in vacation havens all across the country. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang.
Now, let's take a closer look at how vacation destinations are responding with two mayors. First, Shirley Sessions is the mayor of Tybee Island, Georgia. It's a coastal city with a full-time population of just over 3,000 that swells to over 30,000 a day during the summer. Mayor Sessions, thank you so much for talking with us. So tell us, what sort of crowds have you seen over this weekend?
Thank you for having me. We've had a large number, obviously, as anticipated for Memorial Day weekend. It's always a popular holiday. But we saw more than we anticipated simply because of the COVID-19, knowing that people would be coming out, but didn't really know that we would have so many. We had probably an average of about 30,000 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Today, we've seen smaller crowds. I think it started off with a very somber, we had a flyover. The Georgia National Guard flew over in honor of those who have died to give us the freedoms that we enjoy. That kind of set the tone, I think, for the day. The crowds were smaller, but quieter, although clearly probably 20, 25,000 still.
That's a lot of people to manage. Were people, Mayor Sessions, were they social distancing? What kinds of things did you see? Were they wearing masks?
Not many masks. Our governor sent the Department of Natural Resources down to help with social distancing. So that was a big plus.
Did you feel that you had the public health safeguards in place that you needed? I was reading, or we heard in the report earlier, in the program that you had, what, a gift shop owner saying, this is when the businesses in Tybee Island need to be open. They need to be open for business.
We have many of the restaurants who are open with limited seating. They are really doing a good job of social distancing. And when they do visit our restaurants or our shops, we're trying to encourage people to take responsibility for themselves and adhere to the guidelines that CDC and the health department have set forth. Our restaurant and shop owners are doing a really good job of trying to keep their businesses safe.
But we know that when Governor Kemp opened up the beaches in Georgia in early April, you did openly object to that. You told him you thought it was unsafe. Do you think the situation has improved since then?
I did not agree with the governor at that time. I think mainly because we local municipalities had been instructed by the president and by the governor to decide what was best for their communities, and we did that. So we were caught off guard, as were other communities, when that was overturned. So it was a shock. We got past it. And again, I don't know who's his advisors or what decisions he made. I respect his decision. Doesn't mean that I agree with all of his decisions, as I'm sure he didn't agree with my decisions. But Judy, this was never a political situation. Tybee is, I'm bipartisan. It has nothing to do with politics. And I have the deepest respect for our governor, but it was just a matter at the time. I thought that we were in a good place. We were really making progress. And we just had to kind of learn to start over. But again, we've moved on. And I think that his intention was to get the economy going again. I think that that's happening. And my goal is to keep our residents, our businesses, and our visitors as safe as possible. That is still my goal.
Well, Mayor Shirley Sessions, we certainly wish you the best with that. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you, Judy. And you take care. Come and see us.
Now to Missouri and the mayor of a city at the Lake of the Ozarks. Osage Beach is along the eastern edge of the lake. It has a year-round population of about 4,000. But when summer comes, it multiplies many times over. And as we saw earlier, there were viral pictures of crowds there this week. John Oliver Ree is the mayor, and he joins me now. Mayor Oliver Ree, thank you very much for being with us. So tell us, what sort of turnout are you seeing? We did see those pictures of a big crowd at least one pool party over the weekend.
Well, Memorial Day weekend is one of the three busiest times of the year for us. On the holiday weekends, Memorial Day, Labor Day, and the 4th of July, we see normal crowds of this size. I wasn't expecting it as much this year. We didn't have a good forecast for weather. And of course, with the pandemic being what it is, I wasn't quite sure, what the crowds were going to be like. But when the weather cleared up and I think people are ready to get out, reservations started coming in about 5 to 7 days ago, and it looked like we were going to have a full house. And that's exactly what we had.
Did you feel that your community was prepared for what might be crowds this size? What concerns did you have going in?
We expected, again, seeing that the numbers in hotel reservations, lodging reservations, were coming in pretty strong, that we would expect a large number of folks. Now, the issue, of course, is the pandemic and how to deal with it. We knew that if we had large crowds, it was going to be hard to control the social distancing. And I think what most folks have seen from some of the social media is that some went way overboard.
How did you deal with that? I mean, once you were aware of that particular event where we saw what it looked like hundreds of people around a pool, what were you able to do about it? I mean, what kind of controls do you have in place?
Well, actually, we leave it to the responsibility of the business owners to control, their guests. We don't have any enforcement that we were directly responsible for. We have a governor's order in place that puts the responsibility for enforcement on our health department. We have a county health department, and while they are, I would say, fairly understaffed to handle not only their day-to-day operations, but certainly to address all the pandemic responsibility that goes along with it, we are here to support them, should we, get requests from them to respond.
So when a business, when you see an event like what we see in these social media pictures, the video, is there anything you can do about it? To make sure it doesn't happen again is what I'm asking.
Well, from an enforcement standpoint at the time, that responsibility is for the health department to notify us and ask for our assistance if they need it. As far as situations like this happening in the future for other, holiday weekends, we're certainly going to take a look at this, meet with the health department and find out, how we might better be able to control something like this.
Mayor, if I could ask, why is it important to your community to be open right now for visitors, for tourists?
Well, quite frankly, I think it's important for our businesses to be open. If we were to allow our businesses to force our businesses to continue to be closed, we would be, jeopardizing their ability to open up in the future. This also gives our workforce an opportunity to come back to work and to, earn a living and support their families. And both of those are very, very important to us.
Well, Mayor John Oliverie of Osage Beach in Missouri at the Lake of the Ozarks, we thank you very much and wish you the very best.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate you having me today.
With the general election just a little more than 5 months away, we examine how President Trump and Vice President Biden are faring in some of the key battleground states and more with Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report and host of Public Radio's Politics with Amy Walter, and Tamara Keith of NPR. She co-hosts the NPR Politics podcast. Hello to both of you on this Memorial Day, and it is just a little more than 5 months until Election Day, so never too soon to start talking about the general election. We've been looking at the polls. We know it's early. And Amy, I want to start with you because in, I guess, a handful of the key battleground, these states that are going to be really hard fought, we are seeing Joe Biden ahead in a number of states that Donald Trump ended up winning. Pennsylvania, Joe Biden's up 7. Michigan, he's up 6. Arizona, up 4. Wisconsin, up 3. Florida, up 3. Now, I know several of those are within what we call the margin of error, Amy, but is this a headache for Donald Trump at this point? And if so, I mean, how much of a headache?
Well, Judy, from the very beginning of this reelection campaign for the president, we knew that there was going to be the major question was, what is President Trump's ceiling? If you look at the polling throughout his presidency, you can see that he has a pretty low ceiling. He has very rarely gotten above 45% job approval rating, which suggests that it's going to be hard for him to get above the level he got in the last election, which was 46% was his popular vote total. The Democrats are hoping that that actually is his ceiling and that Democrats will win. Joe Biden will win because he's going to win over those candidates who didn't vote for Donald Trump, but also didn't vote for Hillary Clinton. You know, you think about a place like Wisconsin, it was 22,000 votes, just a very narrow margin that Donald Trump won that state. The number of people who voted for Jill Stein in Wisconsin was 30,000. Another 100,000 voted for Gary Johnson. So just getting some of those people back, the theory goes, there goes Wisconsin. The president's team suggests, though, that his ceiling is not as static as the polls look because they're going to increase the pool of voters. They're not just going to win back or win over voters from 2016. They're going to get more people to actually vote who didn't show up in 2016. And in places like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Michigan, those kinds of people who don't turn out and vote traditionally, who didn't vote out in 2016, didn't vote in 2016, look a lot like the president's supporters. They're overwhelmingly white. Overwhelmingly, they do not have a college degree. There are more of those types of voters in a place like Wisconsin than there are voters of color or white voters with a college degree. So, Judy, that's really the battle right here, which is if you look just at who can get to 50%, Democrats argue that the president can't hit that number. But the president's team argues there are going to be a whole bunch of people who show up on Election Day that you're not counting on. I still would rather be in Joe Biden's position right now than the president. He is the president's definitely playing defense a lot more than an incumbent president should be. But that's what we're going to be watching as we go through this campaign.
So, Tam, is the White House, is what we see the president saying and doing and what the White House and the campaign are doing, does it seem designed to add those voters that Amy's talking about?
Well, the voters that Amy is talking about are not, you know, going and finding women in the suburbs who are maybe turned off by Trump and are going to vote for them. What the Trump campaign is looking for are people who are just like the people who voted for him in 2016, but who didn't show up. And so they are doing things that are designed to reach those people. They have this new app where they're trying to get people to share with their friends and they've gamified it. And inside of that app, President Trump is sort of a perfect version of himself. And Joe Biden in that app and in other ways that the campaign communicates is no good, terrible, and a puppet of China. So in terms of what they're doing to reach people, they're absolutely, as one Democratic consultant put it, trying to keep them outraged so they stay engaged. Then on the other side of the ledger, they are going after Vice President, former Vice President Biden. They've been running ads in swing states, going after him on China, his week on China. And also, they've really been outspending him in social media ads as well, including jumping on his remarks on the Breakfast Club that offended some people, many people, jumping on those and already running Facebook ads, promoting a T-shirt based on those remarks, and also putting videos out there showing people upset about what Biden said.
Where he appeared to take the black vote for granted and then later took it back and said that he had made a mistake, didn't mean to say that. But Amy, the president also is kind of venting over the weekend. I'm asking about who the voters is he's appealing to, because he's, you know, tweeting about Joe Scarborough, the MSNBC television journalist who, you know, there's nothing to this. It's completely uncorroborated. The president refers to somebody who died on his staff. President very critical of Nancy Pelosi and suggested she has a drinking problem, went after Stacey Abrams and her weight. The Georgia governor, former Georgia legislator. Are these the kinds of things that do keep his base riled up and do bring in those other voters that he needs?
You know, there was a slogan on the Trump campaign in 2016, which is still the case today, which is just sort of let Trump be Trump. He is who he is. And I think voters have sort of priced that into their opinions of this president. But what he's doing that is really dangerous is he's putting out, as you said, these uncorroborated stories and conspiracies, which he's done for his entire career. But now he's doing it as president of the United States. And once they get out there and then they get picked up by traditional media outlets or people who are seen as more credible, it's hard for regular Americans to decide, well, which of these things is true and what's not. And so the more he stirs the pot, the more he makes it difficult for people to sort of pick out what's truth from fiction, what is a conspiracy versus something that actually really happened. The easier it is for him to make the case, as Tam pointed out, about how the system is rigged against him or how Joe Biden is really the bad one in this case. And again, I think so much of this is trying to take it away from being a referendum on his handling of this pandemic, his handling of the job as president, and to put the onus onto everybody else and specifically onto Joe Biden, make it a referendum on things that you don't like about Joe Biden instead of a referendum on the person who's actually sitting in the White House.
Which is the question, Tam. I mean, this is a year, if ever a president was going to be judged on his leadership in crisis, this has to be it. And yet this is what the president is making noise about.
Well, we're coming up on a really grim milestone of 100,000 deaths from the coronavirus. President Trump doesn't want to talk about that. I mean, he did have flags lowered to half staff over the weekend to honor those victims and their families. But he doesn't want to talk about that. He wants to move on. He wants to say, all right, this is in the rearview mirror. Let's talk about, America is open for business. He's talking about the transition to greatness now. He has moved on. It's not clear that the rest of the country has moved on as the death toll continues to rise. But certainly these tweets are they don't set records, actually, in terms of the numbers. He was not off the charts in that way over the weekend. But he's clearly just, throwing spaghetti against the wall.
These subjects seem to be things that are far from what's at the center of most voters' mind and attention right now. On this Memorial Day, we want to thank both of you so much. Very good, as always, to have you with us. Amy Walter, Tamara Keith, we thank you.
You're welcome.
This Memorial Day, we remember veterans who died in combat. Since the end of World War II, nearly 75 years ago, many Western countries have not had to face deaths at such a large scale. But COVID-19 has changed all that. Special correspondent Malcolm Brabant has been asking how the reality of the pandemic might change the way we talk about life and loss.
Insights from three survivors who witnessed slaughter. Norwegian Bjørn Ihle escaped the massacre of 69 young people by a right-wing gunman on the island of Utøya in 2011.
We are all going to come out of this with our stories of loss. We are all going to be affected in some way or another.
Syrian dissident Omar al-Shogre withstood torture and murder in a notorious death camp of the Assad regime.
Everybody gonna die. What you want is, like in a prison, prisoners wanna die, but they wanna die, they wanna sleep and don't wake, you know? They don't wanna feel the pain of dying.
World War II medic Ray Lambert saved scores of lives on Omaha Beach on D-Day in 1944.
The longer that a person has, knowing that they're going to die, the more the concern that they are of dying.
Death is an incredibly taboo subject and very difficult for many people, and that makes us extremely ill-informed.
Rosie Inman Cook runs a non-profit that encourages people to discuss end-of-life wishes so they can better prepare for death.
This awful pandemic is bringing home to people that they are not immortal. For so long, we've all lived in this glorious golden world in the Western world, haven't we, where a lot of us haven't experienced any deaths of close relatives or friends until we're in middle age. And this is really bringing it home to a lot of people how vulnerable we are as humans.
The ancient Greeks believed the dead had to cross the river Styx to enter the underworld or the afterlife. The concept of heaven sustained Omar al-Shogre as he languished in Syria's Sadnaya prison, where more than 13,000 executions have taken place and al-Shogre was almost beaten to death.
Just the bells, it's like if it's a rainy day, it's what the bells just coming and people hitting me and like metal and electricity and like without stop, it's just getting hurt of everything.
Is there some sort of inner strength that you tapped into that perhaps other people have that can save them?
During my time in prison, we created this survival mechanism in our brain where you think about everything as the best moment of your life. So when they torture me, I count the belts they hit me with. How many belts? And the time when they hit me with the belt, I imagine a tree growing in my garden in the paradise to make that concrete for myself.
For the more secular, or humanists, death is the very end. But according to Rosie Inman Cook, that doesn't stop people from being irrational or superstitious.
For a lot of people, they still can't make a will because they think they're tempting fate. They can't talk about their own death because they think they're going to induce it. There's a lot of fear.
Ray Lambert is currently locked down in North Carolina. We met in Normandy a year ago by the rock on Omaha Beach, where, despite being shot twice and having a broken back, he treated the wounded and won the Medal of Honor.
When the ramp went down, every man was killed. Not one man got off that. And so they all had to be heroes.
What about society as a whole? How do we have to change our attitudes in order so that we're not overwhelmed with fear of other people dying, of people close to us dying?
We knew that we had 15% of the troops going in that day that would die, but that wasn't on our minds so much. So the continuous talk about this is causing people to be nervous and getting angry about things. And if we could just stop that, then it would be a lot easier.
Unlike Lambert, Bjørn Ihle had no training to prepare for his brush with death. 6 years ago, we went to the place where Ihle faced the gunman and his Breivik.
I stood up at one point and he aimed at me and fired. And I fell, but I wasn't hit. It was a terrible shot, luckily.
Despite the growing pandemic death toll, Ihle believes some good can emerge.
It's given people knew connections to what they value, and I think that might shape also how we deal with things after the lockdown, after we get back to some sort of new normal where we might hold on to some of those things that we value.
Are you saying that the proximity to death might actually enhance our lives?
Yes, I'm saying both that the proximity to death, the awareness that life is fragile and life is short, that we have right now, enhances our appreciation of what we have right now.
Having survived Syria, Omar al-Shoghri follows this mantra.
People had to accept walking on two different lines. The line of living, working on your life like you will never die, and the line where you work on your life like you're dying tomorrow.
With the global death toll nearing 350,000, Rosie Inman Cook made this appeal.
This recent pandemic has brought on the need to discuss it with our nearest and dearest. If we don't talk about it, it makes it more awkward and more taboo and more disruptive, more distressing, more catastrophic when it happens.
Our existence now may be less certain than before, but for centuries there has been consistent advice from giants such as Leonardo da Vinci, who said, "A life well used brings a happy death." So start living. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Malcolm Brabant.
People across the world have been turning to screening services during the quarantine period in record numbers. Last month, Netflix says that it doubled its number of new subscribers. One of the new binge-worthy watches is Netflix's Never Have I Ever from actor and producer Mindy Kaling. Amna Nawaz has this look at a new story being told by new voices as part of our Race Matters series. Her report is also part of our ongoing look at arts and culture, Canvas.
Love that bread soda.
Do people call it that?
Yeah, I think they do.
The coming of age series tracks the trials and tribulations of 15-year-old Debbie.
I'm so sorry, that was such a weird thing to say.
It's all right. You're a weird girl.
Whose parents emigrated from India to Los Angeles in 2001.
Do you mind going to the store and buying me a thong?
What?
After a horrible freshman year, Debbie, played by Maitreyi Ramakrishnan, wants to change her social status, but her friends, family, and feelings don't make it easy for her. When Debbie's father passes away, she also has to deal with grief. You thought you
found a friend.
One of the stars of the show, Poorna Jagannathan, known for roles in acclaimed dramas like nice The Night Of.
Sorry to disturb.
I want to go back to yesterday.
And Big Little Lies, joins this cast as Nalini, Debbie's mother.
The humor is built on top of an iceberg of grief.
Jagannathan said watching the final episode in lockdown, even for her, was an intense experience.
I had obviously shot the show, I've read the script, I've done everything, but it was a very emotional experience for me. And when I was trying to unpack why, I think the series lets you grieve. Lets you grieve, of course, for the people you may have lost. But I think it also is an opportunity to grieve our time, grieve for a way of life, grieve for the vast unknown in front of us. And I think that's why it may have resonated.
But there's also humor, which often comes from the unexpected narration of tennis legend John McEnroe.
Drunk and rude, Davey was indulging in what I would call self-destructive behavior.
Who, according to Debbie, held a special place in her late father's heart.
Doesn't let anyone push him around. Look at him, giving it back to that umpire. He's a firecracker.
Tell me what drew you to want to be a part of this project in the first place.
What drew me to it, of course, initially was being part of the Mindy Kaling brand of comedy. Mindy Kaling's sense of humor is very aligned with my sense of humor.
Did you get a bone?
Hey, babe, this is disgusting.
Okay.
And as I got deeper into the process, just the opportunity to play an immigrant mom. You know, I'm an immigrant mom. I'm raising a child, a teenager in Los Angeles. The parallels were really something I'm drawn to.
Your family's originally from India. Mindy Kaling's family is also originally from India. How did all of that lived experience inform how these stories were told and which stories were told in each episode?
From day one, we entered a set and there was a sense of belonging that was immediate. And what that means is every single aspect is something that you can have input on, which I've never experienced that. There's a lot of Indian writers on staff and a lot of writers with immigrant parents on staff, and that really, really showed up in the writing. And so everything feels very true, feels very lived in. Who's gonna stop me? Watch me flex on them. there's a TikTok video made, and you know, the mother pulls her in to put a t-shirt underneath her dress. It's, you know, it's an experience that one of the writers had, and that will find its way in. Take a flick, see my fit, it's a
fit, it's a fit. There's another constant thread throughout all of the narratives, this whole balancing of cultures that we've seen in other shows before, even in other comedies before, right?
I would shrink my shoulders.
I'm thinking of Eddie Huang's Fresh Off the Boat.
The Immigrant Shrivel.
Or Margaret Cho's series, All American Girl, back in the 90s.
Our society considers John Tesh a Renaissance man.
There are scenes in the episodes, like a Hindu ceremony, where Devi is kind of trying to figure out where she fits in and how to balance those things.
Pray you get into Princeton. Don't waste your prayers on stupid things like world peace.
That's something that a lot of first-generation and second-generation Americans can relate to. Is that the intended audience for these kinds of stories?
For the South Asian audience, it feels amazing that this show is out there because they feel seen and they feel like their experiences are reflected.
Everyone having fun at my slumber party?
So yes, it is amazing to see ourselves represented. I don't think the show would have done as well as it has if it's only appealing to a South Asian audience, though. There is something about the show, something about its themes around belonging and not belonging. This show, I think, has very universal themes around which it's built.
Some of those topics are very tough things to talk about. Immigration is incredibly divisive right now in America. Grief is something all Americans can relate to. Are there lessons to be learned from the ways those kinds of difficult things are handled in this series?
First generation kids have the agency to write stories, right? And a lot of times they're writing about their own experiences, and their parents are often the foils. They're often the obstacles to getting what they want.
This project is not yet done. Have you partnered with stupid people?
And particularly, I can speak to the character of the South Asian mother. She's often a caricature, or she's often not given agency at all. She's often submissive within the larger family dynamics. An opportunity to give space and give breath, give air and life to an immigrant story is helpful for everyone. It helps humanize those around you. The grocery workers you see, the frontline healthcare workers you see, your neighbors, you know, the people in your life. I just think the show fosters a sense of community, a sense of family, a sense of belonging, a sense of coming together that people are desperately looking for right now.
A sense of community when we can all really use it. That is Poorna Jagannathan's star of the new Netflix series, Never Have I Ever. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
We end this Memorial Day with soldiers from the Army's 3rd U.S. Infantry Regiment, known as the Old Guard, who have kept watch over the tomb of the unknown soldier at Arlington Cemetery around the clock for more than 70 years. Now, a look at how that tradition endures, even through a pandemic. This March, Arlington National Cemetery closed to most visitors as COVID-19 hit the nation's capital. But at the tomb of the unknown soldier, the cemetery's most iconic memorial, the watch never stopped.
If it's thunderstorms, if it's raining, if it's a hurricane, or if it's a coronavirus, we are always here. We are always guarding.
Sentinels from the United States Army have guarded this tomb 24 hours a day since 1948.
It's a very unique time for us to be in Arlington because there's no one in here. I think that's honestly when we feel closest to what we do. When we feel closest to the unknowns is when no one's here.
Tomb guards now wear masks in their quarters as they prepare for their watch. Oh! The changing of the guard ceremony has also been adjusted to allow for more distancing between personnel. While the pandemic has disrupted traditions for many across the country, the Old Guard see the importance of fulfilling this duty.
I think it's important for us to show to this country that we haven't forgotten, that we will never forget the sacrifices that these soldiers made.
And it says everything about what we value as Americans. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff on this Memorial Day. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you, stay safe, and we'll see you soon.